Every fall, we are treated to the announcements of the Nobel Prizes. They save the best for last, of course, economics. Here is the 2015 announcement.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel to Angus Deaton for his analysis of consumption, poverty, and welfare.
Let's put aside for a moment that the Nobel in Economics is not a real, original Nobel Prize. We'll get into that later. Let's start by congratulating Angus Deaton, a Scottish-born scholar who's been at Princeton for many years. He's best known for bringing an empirical zeal to the study of how individual people spend, save, invest, and so on, and how those choices are connected to poverty and wealth. By linking detailed individual choices and aggregate outcomes, the Nobel Committee declared, his research has helped transform the fields of microeconomics, macroeconomics, and development economics. Within the economics profession, Deaton is widely revered. The award surprised few and delighted many. So, that's great news for Angus Deaton. But what about the rest of us, who haven't yet won our Nobel? How are we supposed to get hold of one?
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Alfred Nobel, born in Stockholm in 1833, was a chemist, an engineer, an inventor, and an entrepreneur. He held more than 350 patents, many of them concerning weaponry and explosives, which in a world often at war were always in demand. And that's how Nobel made much of his fortune. One popular story, perhaps apocryphal, says that in 1888, when his brother Ludwig died in France, the newspapers there mistakenly reported that Alfred Nobel had died. As the story goes, one obituary was headlined, "Le marchand de la mort est mort," the merchant of death is dead. Having been able to read his own obituary, some historians have speculated, Nobel was inspired to establish an award that might lead to his being remembered differently. Whatever his motivation, when Alfred Nobel died in 1896, childless, he left a will demanding that his estate be used to fund annual prizes to people who have, quote, conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. There would be prizes in five categories: literature, peace, physics, chemistry, and in medicine or physiology. The Nobel Prize has, of course, become one of the most famous and well-regarded prizes in the world, with winners to match. Among the Peace Prize winners are Theodore Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., and Mother Teresa. In literature, Hemingway, Shaw, Camus. In the sciences, Albert Einstein, Sir Alexander Fleming, Pierre and Marie Curie. And in economics, wait a minute, who said anything about a Nobel Prize in economics?
The economics prize in the memory of Alfred Nobel is not one of the original Nobel Prizes that, you know, Alfred Nobel put in his will.
We have a very special guest today on the program. His name is Per Stromberg.
I'm a professor of finance at the Stockholm School of Economics, and I'm also one of the members in the prize committee for the prize in economics in the memory of Alfred Nobel.
Which means that he can tell us everything there is to know about how to win a Nobel Prize in economics. Right?
So I'm actually not allowed to talk so much about what happens.
Well, we'll see about that, Per. Let's start with the basics. The Economics Prize was established by the Swedish Central Bank in 1968, nearly seven decades after the original prizes.
When they created it, they wanted it to be a prize in the Nobel family, if you will, and should basically follow the same principles, the same procedures, the same amount of rigor as the other Nobel Prizes in chemistry and physics and so forth.
Because it is not one of the original Nobel Prizes and was created many years later, there are always those people who consider it therefore not a, quote, official Nobel Prize. It's technically called the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel. So whenever anybody writes, so-and-so won the Nobel Prize in Economics, there's always one or two people out there who say, well, it's not really a Nobel Prize. Can you just address that head on for a moment? Should we care that it's not one of the official original prizes?
You know, I think pretty much everyone would agree that this is the most prestigious prize there is worldwide in economics, and probably the most prestigious prize we have in social sciences more broadly in the world. And, you know, part of the respect that this prize carries with it has to do with the fact that we are part of the Nobel family. I think that the reason why the Nobel, if we call it the Nobel in economics, is the most prestigious prize is not because we pay the most money, because there are other prizes around the world that are richer in dollar terms, but I think it's because of the rigor in the selection process that we apply.
Alfred Nobel's will designated which institutions would be responsible for conferring which prizes. The prize in medicine or physiology would be chosen by the Karolinska Institute, a prestigious medical university near Stockholm. The literature prize would come from the Swedish Academy. The Nobel Peace Prize is awarded by a 5-person committee that is elected by the Norwegian parliament. It's the only Nobel Prize that does not originate in Sweden. Now, why is that? Even the Nobel Prize Committee doesn't know for certain why Alfred Nobel wanted it that way. One reason may have been that Sweden had a deeper militaristic tradition than Norway, which made Norway the more natural place to deploy a peace prize. The Nobel Prizes in Chemistry and Physics were to be conferred by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which would also become the decider of the Economics Prize.
Basically, it was a joint initiative by the central bank at the time and the governor of the central bank. But there were obviously a group of economists at the time that felt that economics was becoming an important and rigorous topic and was sort of worthy of this type of prize.
I could imagine that if I'm a serious academic psychology researcher or sociology researcher or anthropologist or whatnot, even though you do occasionally cross over borders, I could imagine feeling very left out.
I think it's a good point you're making. I mean, I want to make clear, though, that the prizes in what we call economic sciences, so maybe I'm playing with words here, but the economic sciences formally, you know, the way we, at least in our interpretation, encompasses basically all social sciences to the extent that they are dealing with economic issues. So in principle, that means that we could give prizes in, and have given prizes more in political science, sociology, psychology, history, and so on, you know, as far as the subject matter sort of pertains to economics. But that said, I guess economics is sort of in somewhat imperialistic discipline, and we have become the strongest of the social sciences. So I guess it was natural that the prize started there.
It may be true, as Stromberg says, that the prize started in economics because it has become the strongest of the social sciences. But it's worth asking, how much did the Nobel Prize help economics become the so-called strongest of the social sciences? Just imagine if sociology or political science had been granted a Nobel Prize way back in 1968. Maybe they'd be the strongest. As for Stromberg's point about how imperialistic economics has become, that's harder to argue with. On this program alone, we've heard about economics being used to make movies more suspenseful.
We view the construction of suspense and surprise as basically optimally economizing on a scarce resource.
To change our eating habits.
If he says he's gonna go on a diet next week, he goes on a diet next week.
Even how to modernize organ transplantation.
So, Grandpa, tell me again, you used to cut the organ out of a dead person and sew it into a sick person, and that was modern medicine?
Those voices belong to Jeff Ely on suspense, Richard Thaler on diet, and Al Roth on organ transplantation. Al Roth, in fact, won a Nobel Prize for his work. Richard Thaler may get one someday for his help creating behavioral economics. But of course, no one can say for sure. That will be decided by people like Per Stromberg. He is one of 6 primary members of the Economics Prize Committee. There are also 4 associate members who are consulted for their expertise. Committee members are elected for a 3-year term and can serve up to 3 terms. How'd you get on the committee, Per?
I was asked, so there's a, what do you call it, nominating committee that is appointed by the Royal Academy of Sciences, and they come up with proposals, and if the Academy thinks it's a good idea, they ask that person. So I don't know how heated the debate was before I was asked, but...
Nobel Prize committee members don't do a lot of media interviews, and the particulars of the selection process are intended to be kept secret. It's all sealed for 50 years. Stromberg made it clear repeatedly that in our conversation, certain lines could not be crossed.
Yeah, so I'm getting now close to things that are bordering the confidentiality I'm under, unfortunately. I don't want to delve into... I'm bordering dangerous territory here. So maybe I'm going to disappoint you here, but all the deliberations that take place and the voting and the discussions and so on are also confidential. So I'm actually not allowed to talk so much about what happens.
Because the economics prize is relatively young, we haven't passed the 50-year secrecy limit on even its earliest winners, but we can share some details about other prizes. A few years ago, it was revealed that J.R.R. Tolkien was nominated for the literature prize by his friend C.S. Lewis, but one Nobel jury member thought Tolkien's writing had not, quote, measured up to storytelling of the highest quality. We've learned that John Steinbeck, who did win the literature prize in 1962, was nominated 11 times before winning, going all the way back to 1943. When it comes to the Nobel Peace Prize, things tend to get really political. Mahatma Gandhi never won the prize, but as we learned after the 50-year limit passed, he was nominated 12 times. Some have speculated that the Norwegian juries of that era were loyal to Great Britain and apparently ruled against Gandhi because he implicitly represented a critique of British colonialism. Others have said the Nobel Committee didn't want to increase Hindu-Muslim friction. As for the Nobel Prize in economics, well, despite the obvious limitations, we will give it our best shot to learn how the selection process works. The job of Per Stromberg's committee is to propose winners to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which has the ultimate vote. The academy has 615 members. A majority vote is needed to declare a winner. For the prize that is awarded each October, the process begins the previous September. Nomination forms are sent out to around 3,000 people, including academy members, as well as eminent university professors and former Nobel laureates.
So there's a list of secret list of people, but, you know, prominent researchers in economics and other social sciences around the world are asked to nominate candidates. And those nominations are due sometime in January.
Some of these nominators also send Stromberg's committee brief reports in support of certain candidates. The committee also solicits its own reports. Stromberg says this is one of the most important parts of their work.
Our goal is to keep on scanning the field of economic sciences, broadly speaking. So we, you know, we have our secret book, basically, where we kind of follow up. Okay, this is the this is what people currently, you know, view industrial organization, and this is the current state of labor economics and so on. And to keep this up to date, and we continuously send out these reports, basically scanning the field. So these are super helpful, and they're sent to, you know, really top people in these fields who put a lot of work into these reports. So this is probably our most important input.
And those reports remain confidential for 50 years as well, correct?
Exactly, exactly.
So I did want to ask you about one particular. So Richard Thaler tells me that he was asked many years ago to write a report. He was commissioned to write a report on the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky.
I'm not sure he was allowed to say that, but fine.
Oh, okay. Well, that's his problem, not mine.
He's a friend of mine. That's
okay.
That's fine.
So, okay, let's pretend that it was okay for him to have told me that. Now, what's interesting is that Thaler at the time was much younger than those guys. So the committee was going to people who had been influenced by the people, not people who were the mentors. But what was interesting to me is this was a report that was commissioned in, I believe, the mid-1990s. And then, as it turns out, Amos Tversky tragically died very young. But Danny Kahneman did go on to win the Nobel, even though he's a psychologist by training and a groundbreaking one.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how typical would that recommending report be? A, written by someone who is influenced by the people as opposed to a mentor of, and B, that far in advance of what turned out to be a winning prize?
So if I start with the first question, most of our reports, I would say we ask for a view on the field from someone who's an expert in the field. But occasionally, and especially when you're, you know, a name is converging in a particular field, like Daniel Kahneman, you know, came up, must have come up. I mean, it was before my time, but, you know, I presume he came up a lot as a proposed prize winner in a lot of these reports. Then we can solicit, you know, personal reports on individuals as we sort of hone in on the names. Now, to be honest, we would typically try to get both, you know, cheerleaders as well as critics to get the balanced picture. So it doesn't surprise me that if if Dick wrote the report, but you know, it probably was not the only one.
And I guess that kind of report might have been a little unusual in that this was a field or a subfield that was new, right? Behavioral economics. I mean, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not like you guys don't know what finance is or econometrics
is.
Right. And it's so interesting to me that you would commission these reports kind of prospectively to learn, to educate yourselves about what are the fields that are developing. Can you give us a hint about what sort of fields or subfields within economics, or maybe they're within psychology and sociology and so on, that your committee is particularly interested in these days?
I can't tell you that. I basically view it, it's not so much what we're interested in as what the profession tells us they're interested in. So in terms of the reports, you know, on these fields, we basically try to just have a throw a pretty wide net, okay, across economic sciences and neighboring fields. But the, as I come back to the nominations are indeed very informative about, you know, what the profession thinks. And nominations are also important because we cannot give a prize to someone who has not been nominated. So that's actually a hard rule. But the way I view our job is basically as aggregating the voice of the profession. You know, it's not really our views on what we think is hot and what's not, but we really try to kind of get a sense of, okay, this is, you know, the top researchers in these fields, this is what they believe.
So the committee can't give the prize to someone who hasn't been nominated. They also can't give the prize to someone who's dead. The Nobel Prize is not awarded posthumously. That's why Amos Tversky, who almost certainly would have shared the prize with his longtime collaborator Danny Kahneman, didn't win the prize. And maybe Gandhi, who was assassinated in 1948, would have won a Nobel if he had outlived the various frictions surrounding his nomination. It was June when Per Stromberg and I spoke, which meant the awarding of the Nobel Prize to Angus Deaton was still 4 months away. Over the preceding 6 months, Stromberg and the rest of the committee had been culling the nominations and research reports they received from around the world. Early in this process, they created a long list of potential prize ideas.
And that list typically involves, let's say, a dozen or so potential prizes. And then we divide these 12 prize ideas, let's call them that, among ourselves in the committee and start writing basically the scientific materials and the proposal to see whether it sort of holds up.
Keep in mind that although the prize is awarded to individuals, often more than one individual per year, it's usually the work itself, the breakthrough idea, that's actually being rewarded. That's what Stromberg means by prize ideas.
And then we have meet probably every 4 weeks throughout the spring, and then we vote on which of these 12 proposals should remain in the game until the next meeting and which ones are out, a little bit like a reality show. And
you know, now that you mention it, Per, this would make such a good reality TV show, but I'm guessing you're not willing to share to let the cameras in these rooms, are you?
Well, maybe we can tape it and release it in 50 years if reality shows are still hot. Okay. But kidding aside, so that's sort of how it works. And I think by now we have what we think is the best prize for this year. But we obviously, since we've been working on 12 prizes throughout the spring, we obviously have, you know, plan B if this is not popular.
The committee's idea needs to be popular with the Academy, which, if you examine previous Nobel Prizes in economics, seems to mean being at least a bit in sync with a Scandinavian view of the world. Measured, a bit technocratic maybe, also somewhat humanistic. The French economist Jean Tirole won for his, quote, analysis of market power and regulation. In 2009, the American political scientist Eleanor Ostrom, the first and thus far only female economics laureate, shared the prize with Oliver Williamson. Ostrom was cited for her, quote, analysis of economic governance, especially the commons. And while the committee insists that the prize is given for a body of work and not necessarily for work that intersects with world events, several of the recent prizes, in addition to Tirole's and Ostrom's, seem to speak to the causes and consequences of the Great Recession. As Per Stromberg noted, while his committee steers the choice, it's the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences that ultimately has the power to give the prize.
The day we announced the economics prize in the memory of Nobel, that is the day when the Academy votes. So it's basically we present the proposal and they vote. And, you know, if they vote for our proposal, that's going to be the thing that's announced that day. Now, obviously, we don't take them by surprise at that point. So there's a whole process before that. And actually, one of the important steps is that there's a chapter of the Royal Academy of Sciences, which is the chapter for social sciences. So we first present our proposal to the chapter for social sciences. They vote on whether they want to support this proposal or not. That happens in September.
I see.
And if things go badly, if there's resistance to a prize or something like that, we should know that and have some leeway or some time before the October vote.
Has there been such a case in recent memory, even long memory, where the nominating committee put forward a proposal and the Academy of Sciences committee said, you know, we don't really like the options you've given us. Go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, so I'm getting now close to things that are bordering the confidentiality I'm under, unfortunately.
That's the border we wish to cross, so go ahead and
exactly.
Lead us
across. Exactly. Well, if you do another show in 50 years, we can make it. But, you know, let me put it this way, that there's usually, you know, interesting and constructive discussion when we propose these prizes.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, an interesting and constructive discussion with Steve Levitt, who knows more than a few Nobel laureates.
He said, if winning the Nobel Prize keeps me from playing golf in the morning, I'll consider it the worst thing that ever happened to me.
And if you want to hear from some past and perhaps future Nobel winners, check out the full podcast archives of Freakonomics Radio. Every one of our episodes is available for free in the iTunes podcast store or wherever you get your podcasts or at Freakonomics.com.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The Nobel Prize in Economics, technically the Bank of Sweden Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, comes with a cash award of roughly $1 million. So, how do you get one of those babies for yourself? The first step is to become an economist, although occasionally a political scientist or psychologist will win the prize. You then have to compile a body of research that a handful of Swedish gatekeepers consider world class. You also better be patient. This is not a prize for young people.
We, by necessity, will have to see more evidence of the long-lasting impact before we can give the prize.
That's Per Stromberg, a member of the committee that awards the prize. He makes the point that although the prize is often given for research done while a winner was young, the prize comes only after the research has stood the test of time. Accordingly, the average age of an economics Nobel laureate is 67. But as noted earlier, you can't be so old as to be dead since the prize is not awarded posthumously. Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, is an economist at the University of Chicago. He's seen quite a few of his colleagues win a Nobel.
Roger Meyerson and Jim Heckman and Lars Hansen would be a couple of the people who won the Nobel Prize since I've known them.
And what kind of ideas do you believe are considered most valuable within the economics realm for winning the Nobel? How important or virtuous, let's say, do they need to be?
So in general, I'd say most of the people who won the Nobel Prize have had ideas that have radically changed the way future economists were going to think about problems. Now, what's often funny, though, when they have to characterize what the idea is for, it's tricky for the news media to try to make sense of it. And often the one-line blurb of why someone wins a Nobel Prize will be something completely absurd, like, he made it clear to other economists that when you don't have complete information, you sometimes make bad judgments. And it's interesting because ideas are hard to come by, and ideas are often so obvious ex post that when you summarize them in one sentence for the public, you wonder how in the world could this guy have gotten a Nobel Prize for it. But the details are often the hard part.
And how substantially, or let me just ask, how have you observed that winning the Nobel will change the economist's life and maybe the lives of those around him?
I really haven't seen the Nobel Prize change people's lives much at all. I think the best example would be my good friend Gene Fama. And Gene and I play golf almost every weekend in the morning. And when Gene won the Nobel Prize, he was there for our 7 a.m. golf tee time the next Saturday. And I said, Gene, I didn't expect to see you. And he said, if winning the Nobel Prize keeps me from playing golf in the morning, I'll consider it the worst thing that ever happened to me. And so for Gene, his goal was to change as little as possible. I think for most of the people who win the Nobel Prize, by the time they win the Nobel Prize, they are so prominent and so well equipped to do what they want to do that they more or less just keep on doing exactly that. They just do it with a little swagger in their step and a little more excitement and a lot more bowing by the people who they're talking to.
And what do you know about the selection process? Do you as an economist choose to try to find out how it works? Do you remain wildly oblivious?
So I think almost no one on the planet knows less about the selection process for the Nobel Prize than I do. And the way I know it's Nobel season is that around Chicago, a lot of people tend to get haircuts in the few days leading up to the announcement of the prize. And so if I see all my colleagues with really short, well-maintained hair, I know that the prize must be somewhere right around the corner.
So, does the average would-be recipient have a sense that he or she will win the prize?
You know, it's hard to answer that humbly.
That's Stanford's Al Roth, who, along with Lloyd Shapley, won a Nobel in 2012 for the, quote, theory of stable allocations and the practice of market design.
So, I knew that I was on the big list of people who, if I won a Nobel Prize, it wouldn't cause the Nobel Committee to be embarrassed. You know, the newspapers the next day would not say craziness in Stockholm. But there are many, many people in that category. So indeed, we were asleep. We were not waiting for a call. And it's an interesting call because one of the things they're concerned about, they have a lot of experience with this, is convincing you that it's not a prank. So the person who first spoke to me said, you know, congratulations, you've won the Nobel Prize. And then he said, and I'm here with six of my colleagues, and two of them know you, and they're going to talk to you now.
To persuade you that this is for real.
Right.
Either that or a very elaborate prank.
Exactly.
Angus Deaton, the winner in 2015, had a similar experience. Here he is at a press conference on the day he won.
So Anne, my colleague and wife here, picked up the phone, and I think I picked it up almost the same time, and there was a very Swedish voice from, which is almost enough, you know, and who said, I would like to speak to Professor Angus Deaton, who there is a very important telephone call for him from Stockholm. So then I had a pretty good idea what it was. And then they said some very nice things about me, which was very nice. And then they were very keen to make sure that I did not think it was a prank. And I don't know whether this is common. I've never had a prank phone call telling me. And of course, as soon as they said that, I thought, oh my God, maybe it is a prank.
Per Stromberg was one of the people on the other side of the line this year with Deaton, and also a few years ago with Al Roth. As Stromberg recalled, once the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences voted to give Roth the prize, the committee members got into a room and had some lunch. It must be a wonderful thing to be able to make that call.
It's one of the most gratifying moments of this whole process is to really make this call and hear the reaction of the laureates and so on. It's quite amazing, actually.
And what's it feel like to have so much, I don't want to say power over someone's life, but winning a Nobel, it really changes the trajectory of your life. So can you just talk for a moment about what it feels like to have that kind of ability?
It carries a huge amount of responsibility, obviously. After having been in the committee for a few years, the thing that has impressed me the most is actually the process. You know, so I keep on repeating it, but with the nominations, with the reports, with the work we do, it really makes the process very solid, which also, at the end of the day, I think everyone feels kind of comfortable with these prizes that we propose. So it doesn't feel like, I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but it doesn't feel like you have so much power at the end of the day because the process
is so thorough. Because the process is really, the process is really the power. Yeah,
exactly.
So I've talked to some economists who detect, or at least believe that they detect, a sort of pattern. You know, there's a finance prize every decade or so, the same for econometrics. You throw in a game theory prize once in a while. Even behavioral economics has now entered the mix. So how much emphasis does the committee put on not only rewarding fields that are newer or have coalesced by now,
right,
but in also rotating it to keep things interesting and maybe, you know, for something as simple as making a splash in the wider world?
I think, at least in part, this happens kind of automatically due to the process we follow because, you know, when we start out with a prize, it's typically, you know, we have a topic. Let's take the finance prize as an example. Okay, so we had been investigating asset pricing and empirical work in asset pricing for quite some time because that had emerged as, you know, when people doing reports in finance, that had come up as, you know, the most prize-worthy thing. So that basically means that once we've given the prize in, you know, to Fama Schiller Hansen, there are not a lot of candidates, you know, natural prizes waiting right behind them, right? Because we've kind of, okay, so this was the important, you know, what people believed was the most important contribution in this field, right? So then it's very natural that you move on for the next year to a different field.
When a subfield or an area of economics gets more popular, so behavioral economics, which I've been fascinated by for a lot of years and therefore was thrilled to see Danny Kahneman win the Nobel in economics for it, it's really gained momentum in the public sphere and in the governmental sphere. And there are books, you know, Thaler has published a book, Misbehaving on It. Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, really opened a lot of eyes around the world. And I'm curious, does popularization tend to work in favor of a field that the Nobel Committee may be considering or against it?
I think it's irrelevant if you think about popularization, you know, outside of academic circles, because it is very much about academic contributions and the view of the academic community. So in some sense, it really is not a decision variable that we take much note on.
The John Bates Clark Medal, which is a very prestigious American academic economics award, used to be every 2 years awarded. Now it's every 1 year. But still, it's considered a sort of a junior Nobel. Have you ever looked at the correlation between Clark Medal winners and future Nobel winners? Is it as strong as we think?
Well, actually, you don't have to ask me. You can just calculate the correlation.
Right.
But it is true. And you would find that it's significant. And
well, the only thing we don't know is whether recent winners, especially as it's expanded to annually, stand as good a chance of winning a Nobel as the past winners who won the Clark, right?
Yeah. Let me answer a slightly different question, which is, you know, I think economics and social sciences in general are maybe, they're a little bit more complex than say, some of the natural sciences, because it takes some time before you know how fundamental a contribution is. There's like a longer lag between that a particular research study is done until you actually know whether this was an important finding with long-lasting impact. And arguably, I think the John Bates Clark Medal will naturally have a shorter lag because you give it to good, you know, prominent economists below the age of 40, right?
In 2003, Steve Levitt was awarded the John Bates Clark Medal, which is conferred by the American Economics Association. He was cited for his, quote, pioneering empirical research and for confronting important questions in the economics of crime and political economy.
All right, Levitt, now if I were to ask the average high-quality economist, someone perhaps who's already won the John Bates Clark Medal, someone like you perhaps, what he thinks of his prospects or her prospects to win the Nobel Prize in Economics, what does that person, you for instance, say?
So almost any economist you talk to will say they think their own likelihood of winning the Nobel Prize is really low. But I think that's not what most people really think about their chances. And I remember one person who won the Nobel Prize, and he, like all the other winners, acted so surprised and couldn't believe he had won the Nobel Prize. And at the press conference, his daughter was invited up onto the stage after he had just said, well, you know, what an amazing honor this was, and he couldn't believe it happened to him. He had never expected it. And they asked the daughter, well, what do you think of your father winning the Nobel Prize? And she said, well, thank God he finally won the Nobel Prize. He complains bitterly every single year that he doesn't win it. And finally, we won't have to have that conversation at the dinner table.
Let's say that I want to win your prize, okay? So I'm not, personally, I'm not an economist, but I do collaborate with one, Steve Levitt, who won the Clark Medal at University of Chicago. And we've written a bunch of books about economics, and we make, you know, look, we're making this weekly, we're bringing economics to the whole world via this podcast. So what do I have to do to get your prize? Can you help me out with that?
Well, keep on your good work, doing your good work, and then we'll see if you have enough long-lasting impact on the field and the outside world to merit the prize.
Okay, I better hang up now and get back to my work.
Exactly.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, economists, when not in pursuit of a Nobel Prize, sometimes just want to have fun by arguing, for instance, that Jane Austen was a game theorist.
I mean, to some extent, that's true. I mean, people act strategically all the time.
That's coming up. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you'll find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Okay. Hey, Levitt, what is your personal favorite Jane Austen book? Steve Levitt is a University of Chicago professor in the economics department, not the literature department. So when I asked him about Jane Austen...
Oh, man. Didn't she write a book called Emma?
I wasn't so surprised that the conversation kind of stalled out. Now, why would I ask an economist about Jane Austen, a novelist who died in 1817? Because today's show is about game theory. All right, Levitt, define game theory for me.
I would define game theory as the study of the strategic interactions between a small number of adversaries, usually two or three competitors.
So that sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? Levitt has written several papers that involve game theory, mostly papers about sports and gambling and cheating, things like that. So how does it actually work? Well, here it gets a bit more complicated.
Yeah, so game theory, the promise of game theory, so one of the predictions of game theory is that when you are in, I would describe game theory as a mathematical formalization. So, okay, let me start. So,
Yeah, actually, you know what? Wait, you know, let me
talk about my frustration with game theory, and then I'll go back and say that I actually have written papers.
Great.
Game theory does apply.
Yeah.
So when a pitcher sometimes throws fastballs and sometimes throws curveballs, it must be the case that in the end, the pitcher must be indifferent between whether the guy, you know, game theory sucks so bad because it's so hard. And it's really, because everything is backwards in game theory. I don't even think it's worth talking about because, like, the predictions are just, they're just impossible to describe without going into what equilibrium is. So I don't know how Michael does it.
Did you catch what Leavitt said right there at the very end of his eloquent description of game theory?
So I don't know how Michael does it.
Michael? Who is this Michael?
My name is Michael Che, and I teach here in the political science department, UCLA.
Michael Che, that's C-H-W-E, is an economist by training. Before UCLA, he taught at the University of Chicago. That's how Leavitt knows him.
And my research is on game theory, which is a mathematical subject. Its applications to like social movements and macroeconomics and violence. And this latest thing is about its applications maybe to literature.
Game theory, as Michael Che sees it, is about thinking strategically, making conscious decisions, and making those decisions based on how you anticipate someone else responding to your decision. Think of a decision tree with a lot of branches. So if you would, tell us the name of your most recent book then.
Oh yeah, well it's Jane Austen, Game Theorist.
I have to say, that's one of the best book titles I've heard in a long time.
Oh. Thank you so much.
It's to the point and it's lovely and weird all at the same time. So Jane Austen, Game Theorist. And tell me how the idea took root in your brain.
Well, I mean, I was watching movies with my kids, and we watched Clueless, and I just thought it was a funny movie, and it was all about manipulation. So, you know, that's with Alicia Silverstone. And
Based, we should say, on a Jane Austen novel.
Yeah, Emma. A lot of people feel it's actually the best in terms of the spirit of the novel, adaptation of Emma, which I kind of agree with.
Let's do a makeover.
No.
No.
Oh, come on, let us. Cher's main thrill in life is a makeover, okay? It gives her a sense of control in a world full of chaos.
Please. Sure.
Now, remember, Emma is the one Jane Austen book that Steve Leavitt could name.
I have never read a Jane Austen book. The closest I've come to reading a Jane Austen book is I used to love the movie Clueless with Alicia Silverstone. I watched that over and over, and I think that was actually one of her stories.
So academic economists love Clueless. Who knew? And why might that be? Well, Clueless, adapted from Jane Austen's Emma, is about a young woman who is constantly scheming to set people up romantically. This kind of scheming, it turns out, is not unusual in an Austen novel.
Austen's books are about many things, but really one of the major themes is the whole idea of meddling, manipulation, you know, scheming.
But Michael Che's point isn't just that Jane Austen is doing all this in her novels, Emma and Pride and Prejudice and Mansfield Park and Sense and Sensibility. His point is that she's doing it intentionally, that Jane Austen was a game theorist. And this is noteworthy because she was essentially writing game theory more than 100 years before there was game theory.
I guess you could say, if you're looking historically, that game theory was kind of part of the Cold War ethos in a way. I mean, the idea back then was that, you know, if we somehow modeled things like, you know, nuclear deterrence or like a ship being able to, you know, go after a submarine or something like that, that would have some sort of advantage over the Soviets. But I'm not sure if it really, you know, gives you a huge advantage. It makes you think about things in a more clear way and, you know, brings up in some sense problems which you might not have anticipated. So that's kind of what I think game theory does for us generally. I mean, it doesn't necessarily teach us how to solve the world's problems or anything, but rather it sort of brings up interesting new wrinkles and kind of interesting problems that you hadn't thought about. So, I mean,
yeah, I think a skeptic might say that game theory is a bunch of heavily educated, particularly mathematical people writing down complicated, quote, elegant formulas to, quote, prove what every small business person or housekeeper or anybody has known their entire lives. Can you dispute that?
I mean, to some extent, that's true. I mean, people act strategically all the time. Mm.
So you write that, quote, Austen consciously intended to theorize strategic thinking mm-hmm. her novels. Another right. time, you argue that Austin, quote, explicitly intended to explore the phenomenon, not of game theory mm-hmm. per se, but of strategic thinking. So persuade right. me, first of all, Michael, that you do have explicit proof that this was an intention in her writing and not a case of sort of confirmation bias where you, the game theory scholar, oh. goes back to her writing and says, oh, this matches up very well with what I call this.
Well, I mean, I don't have like a smoking gun kind of like a letter from Austin saying, hey, I'm interested in strategic thinking, but like in Pride and Prejudice. So like, you know, the very first manipulation is, this is kind of what gets the whole novel started is, so, you know, the Bingleys come into town and the Bennet family has 5 unmarried, you know, daughters, and that's kind of a huge problem. So Miss Bennet is super focused on getting her daughters married. And for obvious reasons, you know, it's not like they can get jobs or anything. It's that's the main way either you could become like a governess or get married. That's basically it. So the very first manipulation is Mr. Bingley shows up with his sister and they rent out Netherfield, which is this estate nearby. And so Mr. Bingley's sister invites Jane to come for dinner. And the first manipulation is Miss Bennet says, well, you've got to go on horseback. And people say, the daughters will say, why? Why horseback? You know, shouldn't she take the carriage? And Miss Bennet says, well, it's going to rain. And if she goes on horseback, it's very likely that they will invite her to stay the night. And hence, she'll get to spend more time. So right from the beginning, we have a manipulation. And that was, you know, it seemed kind of silly, but, you know, you have to play for keeps. This is a big deal. You know, if somebody marriageable is nearby and, you know, you have the chance to spend 20 more minutes with that person, you've got to go for it. It's a, you know, life or death is not too strong a way of thinking about this. So that manipulation gets started and it works. I mean, it actually works too well. Jane gets wet in the rain and falls sick and she then spends up, you know, spending several days with Mr. Bingley and it kind of works.
Michael Che has other evidence from Jane Austen's own life.
It used to be thought that Austen was kind of acted alone and wrote in her room and really didn't talk to anybody else. But there's a lot more evidence now of how she was definitely part of the intellectual world. She read Adam Smith, she read Hume, that kind of thing.
So it's interesting. Here's one line that Jane Austen wrote before. This is from it's called a memoir. I don't know this book, A Memoir of Jane Austen by...
Okay. It's by one of her nephews.
Austin Lay? Is that a nephew?
Yeah, exactly right.
So he writes that before she began Emma, that she wrote, I guess, in a journal or a letter, I am going to take a heroine, referring to Emma, whom no one but myself will much like. So she sounds like an economist there, to my mind, because economists are, you know, quite proud of the fact that they can make dispassionate arguments about anything, you know, labor markets, love That's markets, true. And so on. And so I guess what I want to know is how much you know or have thought about or have been able to learn about the kind of person she was and what her family situation was like and how that influenced the way that she thought. You mentioned, you know, she read Smith and Hume and so on. Right. We know she was from gentry, right? Kind of lower gentry level. Is that right?
I mean, there are people who spend their entire lives doing this and reading her letters and trying to get more into it. And I haven't done that as much. I mean, I would simply say that these ideas were floating around, but also at the same time, you know, like in the book, I argue that, you know, a lot of slave folk tales talk about game theory, and it's not like, you know, slaves were in touch with David Hume or anything like that, right? I mean, so I'm arguing that actually, you know, a lot of these things are, you know, kind of close to common sense. It's just kind of like elaborated common sense. Sometimes people say, hey, game theory sounds a lot like common sense. And I say, yeah, it actually does. It is like common sense
and
perfected. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good thing.
Now, one thing that's particularly interesting about Austen is she was obviously a female novelist at the time when there weren't so many novelists at all, and being a female novelist was not the most natural or common thing in the world. And additionally, most of the characters that we really care about are females themselves.
Well, I mean, the book kind of makes an argument that women are generally better at strategic thinking in the real world. So there's some evidence from psychology, like the classic thing is sort of theory of mind tests, like, are you able to put yourself in the mind of another? And like, can you tell somebody's emotions just by looking at their eyes? And women generally tend to be better at this than men.
So let me ask you this question, and this is probably unanswerable, but I want to know what you have to say about it. Let's assume that women are better at what we call strategic thinking than men. Do we have any idea of whether the why in that is something to do with genetics or something to do perhaps with the fact that women are more often in a position where they need to learn to be strategic thinkers because they have historically had a lot less power in a situation like that?
I mean, there might be a genetic explanation. I mean, I'm not going to rule that out, but the book stresses the second one, which is exactly that people who are in situations where they don't necessarily have a lot of power, that's exactly the kind of person who needs and to think strategically. I mean, and kind of in the book, I call this sort of game theory is like one of the original weapons of the weak. I mean, it's one of the original ways of getting ahead if you don't have a lot to start out with. And in some sense, if you already have a lot of power, you don't have to think strategically because everyone else is already doing what they're supposed to do. You know, you're happy with that. And I have a friend, Marek Kaminski, who's at UC Irvine, and he was in a Polish prison. He's Polish, and he was put in prison because of democratic activities he did. And he said, you know, in prison totally trains you to act hyper-rationally because in prison, it's possible that the one right move in just the right spot could give immense consequences, like get you out early or, you know, transfer you to a different cell. So he says the world of prisoners is hyper-rational. So it's exactly this kind of thing, because if you don't have a lot of power, you need to, you know, use whatever agency you have in the best possible way. And strategic thinking is absolutely required.
Let's get back to Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. As you heard earlier, Levitt is not really the biggest fan of game theory.
God, you know, game theory sucks so bad because it's so hard.
Part of this disillusion may be because game theory was supposed to be the next big thing in economics. And then it wasn't.
When I first got introduced to game theory, it seemed to me like it might be the answer to everything important. I think many economists, as game theory got introduced, had that same feeling about how game theory was going to open up the world to economists. And I think in the end, that kind of wondrous promise was never fulfilled. And the difficulty is that game theory really only applies to a narrow set of problems. That's a set of problems where there are just two or three or a very small number of actors. And it really does much better when either the game that is being played is repeated an infinite number of times, the same game is played exactly over and over and over and over to infinity, or is played precisely once. It turns out that in the middle ground of there being a handful of participants or a handful of plays, game theory doesn't often do such a great job of solving our problems. And in the real world, there just aren't very many problems that end up being the right kinds of problems for game theory.
Let me just ask you this, Levitt. What does it take to be good at game theory?
There are two things that are important to doing well in strategic settings. And the first one is knowing enough and being skilled enough to put yourself in the shoes of the other person. So you cannot do game theory unless you can say, if I do this, she will do that. If I do that, she will do this. So that is so fundamental to game theory that if you aren't in the habit or don't have the ability to understand how someone will react, you have no hope whatsoever. The second trait, which is valuable, is to be able to look many steps into the future. So you can be only so good at game theory if you can think to yourself, if I do this, then he does that. Really good game theorists, the most skilled ones, will say, if I do this, then he'll do that, then I'll do this, and he'll do that, then I'll do this, and he'll do that. Okay, and that's kind of the difference between a really good chess player and a not-so-good chess player, is being able to see down the road much further.
But you and I have talked a lot over the years about how the future is essentially unknowable, at least in certain realms and to certain degrees. So how do you get good at or better at knowing what someone else, whether it's a collaborator or an opponent, will do in the future?
Well, I think the answer to that question must be the answer to every question that involves getting good at something, which is feedback. Trying and experimenting and learning whether or not your insights were correct or incorrect, and then updating your behavior as a function of that. I think the only way to learn is to practice, and to practice in settings in which you get good feedback about whether you're right or you're wrong. But, you know, there are substitutes for practice, and that's reading about stuff, right? So if you don't actually necessarily have to do stuff, if you can read about smart people and how they've done things, that is another way to learn.
Huh. That's an interesting idea. Learn to do by reading about stuff. By reading about how smart people do things. By reading an author like, hell, I don't know, Jane Austen?
Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence, and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. She was the youngest of the children.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe. Thanks for listening.